Welcome. This is Abby Strauss. I'm so happy that everybody's here with me and Peter this evening for this teleconference, sponsored, not coincidentally, by the International Center for Spirit at Work. I would like to begin with a quote from Peter's new book called Community, the Structure of Belonging. And after that, I'd like to ask everyone to join me in a moment of silence before we begin the conversation. If it is true that we are creating this world, then each of us has the power to heal its woundedness. This is not about guilt. It's about accountability. Citizens, in their capacity to come together and choose to be accountable, are our best shot at making a difference. So please join me in a moment of silence as we all find our centers and allow ourselves to become fully present with Peter and with each other. Thank you. That was lovely. So now it's my honor to officially introduce our guest, Peter Block. In his own words, Peter's work is about empowerment, stewardship, chosen accountability, and the reconciliation of community. Peter is the author of several best-selling books, including Flawless Consulting, Stewardship, and The Answer to How is Yes. His new book, Community, the Structure of Belonging, was released this month, and I have to say that it's at the top of my must-read suggestions for just about everybody I know, and I have a feeling that it will quickly become another one of his best sellers. It's a terrific book. Peter is a partner in Designed Learning, a training company that offers workshops which he designed to build the skills outlined in his books. And he is a citizen of Cincinnati, Ohio, and is involved there, helping to facilitate conversation and committed engagement in and among groups from all corners of that city. Welcome, Peter. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It is really my pleasure. That's a very kind introduction. Thank you.
Heartfelt, I must say. The word community is central not only to your latest book, the title, and runs through it consistently, but also it seems to me it is central to your work and your life. And as I hear you use the word, it begins with a capital C and means something distinct and something precious, something way deeper than a word that describes a bunch of people in the same place. And I'd love it if you could start by sharing with us what this word means to you and how you became inspired to pursue it as a context for transformation.
Well, you get interested in those things that are absent. I mean, most of my life has been one of extreme independence. And I've lived in cities that I've never known for many of my life, and we all live kind of a gypsy existence. And something in the last 10 years has kind of awoken me to the possibility of caring about a place. And I decided that I would start caring about the place that I lived after I found myself in Cincinnati. And I think it speaks to the isolation and aloneness, the kind of end of neighborhood, the growth of a suburban life, which is a world without sidewalks and front porches. And it just seems that as I think about what's made a difference in the institutions that I've worked in, it was always some quality of connectedness and relatedness. So community to me, some people say I have a community of practice, or I'm in community with people all over the world. But to me, it's finding some place where we're connected, where we belong, where our senses are awakened, where I can see and hear and be close to something other than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it's related to performance. That everything I know about high performance says it comes from connected, related, belonging people. And in this world, that's the exception. Most of our institutions are treating people as if they're replaceable. They take the personal out of experience. And so we're trying to automate the world as fast as we can. The technology is a counterfeit substitute for connection, even though it's extremely useful, like tonight. And so I just think that word is a solution. It's an answer to symptoms. Like in most businesses, if you say we have a problem in performance or in cost or in market, in the city, if we have a problem with safety, to me, those are symptoms, and the cause, what's beneath those symptoms, is the absence of community and connectedness. And so you might say that connectedness or relatedness or community is the foundation of accomplishment. So that gives it an importance. And so I've kind of organized my life around that, and it's overcome some of my aloneness in where I live. It also has forced me to care about what I look like when I go into town now, because I know people. Which is the price I pay. So I have to look in the mirror, and there's a pair of shoes I cannot wear into town because they would embarrass me if anybody saw me that I knew. But it's all of that.
Well, it sounds like we could have a whole other call about wardrobe and community. So it sounds fascinating. That's wonderful. You know, I had a question that I was going to ask later on, but this is the perfect segue for it that I'm going to go for it. Increasingly, people are gathering online and what's come to be called loosely as virtual communities, you know, either in like social networking groups or communicating by email, web applications, things like that, and of course in the ubiquitous conference call. And in reading your book, one of the questions that kept coming up is that people, part of the idea of gathering in community, the way I understand you to express it, is very much about bodies in the same space.
Right.
And I'm interested in your take on how we can combine the very best of this technological element with the very best of community, with the very best of being together. And if you want to table this question for later, that's fine too.
Yeah.
It just sort of came rolling out here.
Well, I just think technology is a tool. You know, it's not the point. It's a tool. And it's a great tool. I like it. I love technology. I'm an early adopter. You know, I buy things I don't know how to use, but I love the process of buying them. But I think it's a great tool, but I don't think it's a substitute. You know, you talk about a virtual community, a virtual life. A friend of mine, I said, you know, those flowers aren't real. They're plastic. He said, yeah, they're real plastic. And so I just want to keep it in proportion and say it's a nice tool, but it doesn't solve anything. It just makes certain things easier and more efficient. It doesn't solve our need for connectedness. It doesn't answer the questions of purpose that we have. It doesn't help me find meaning in my life or overcome my fear of my boss. So if you say, well, so what matters in life? Which is about relatedness and purpose and the sense of finding your voice, finding your legs to stand on, feeling you're doing something useful that's serving the world, which all of us feel. I don't think the technology answers those questions. It's just a useful way for us to, an efficient way for us to communicate, to get information, exchange information. And I just want to keep it in proportion. And at another level, every time you argue on the benefit of cost or speed, you're taking a stance against democracy, you're taking a stance against real community, you're taking a stance against. So the arguments against a democratic society is it takes too much time. Or the arguments against a participative organization or an empowered organization or all the other words we use, it's never opposition to the idea. It's always say, well, it takes too much time, it costs too much, we can't afford. And so I'm wary of all the conversations about speed, time, scale, because it seems like they have a political curriculum, which is to keep people apart, which makes them easier to control.
Mm. So you speak in the book about how the way we gather is fateful. Specifically, you say that every time we gather becomes a model of the future we want to create.
Well,
so could you talk a little bit about what that is?
I wish you'd said that before I wrote the book. It is fateful. See, most of us on this call know how to facilitate. We know how to bring people together, but it's treated as an afterthought or something on the side. The most planning for gatherings is worried about content and the presentation of that content. What are we going to talk about? How are we going to present it? And so I'm trying to take what we thought was peripheral, what we thought was an afterthought, or something that we can pay attention to at the last minute, and make it central. Because I do believe that when we gather is the moment that we decide what kind of culture this is. And I've been in hundreds of meetings and participated myself where the content dominated. And sometimes the content is about participation, it's about teamwork, it's about empowerment, but the process of the meeting is not that. It's question and answer is the participative methodology of patriarchy. And so what I'm really trying to do is take what people on this call know to be useful and make it important, and say that how we sit in the room, how we engage people with each other, not with the leader, is fateful, like you say, that that's what makes the difference in impacting and making a difference in people's lives. No speaker, no leader, no matter how powerful, makes a difference in people's lives. It's peers' experience with each other. It's citizens engaging each other. That is transformative. So if we care about transformation, then we stop putting our eyes on the leader and we put our eyes on peers, employees, citizens in their relationship with each other rather than their relationship with their boss. And what's the place where we could have an impact on their relationship with each other? It's when we gather. It's when we come together. And so you become a little bit obsessed and mad, crazy about, well, what kind of room is it? Does it have windows? A room without windows makes nature obsolete. So how can I find an alternative future without something natural happening? An alternative future is the way people sit in a circle. So when I show up, I'm always rearranging the room. I become a rather aging interior designer. And the circle is the symbol of community, of connection. So seats in a circle, 6 or 8 people, is the form that best communicates, you know, what it takes for transformation to happen. And so then what leadership becomes is people who have the facilitative capacity that has been kind of sequestered into specialists, which is us, coaches, which is us, consultants, which is us. And so that, the hardest thing is what is it's too simple. It's simple in our minds. We know how to do it. You get people together, give them 20 minutes of content or the future or context, and then basically say, how do we create questions that engage citizens with each other in a way that deepens their sense of connection, and out of that grows their sense of accountability for participating in this future we have in mind.
You know, when we have these gatherings, so much of the time it seems that we're trying to reach consensus. We want everybody to end up agreeing. And I
know.
I just adore that you say that no is the beginning of commitment.
I love that too.
It really rocks. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you know, my in high control systems, there's no space for dissent. It's considered disloyalty. And to me, as soon as you make dissent a problem, saying no is the extreme of dissent, as soon as you do that, you eliminate space for real commitment. And until you can say no, your yes doesn't mean anything. And then my favorite image is, will you marry me? And the other person says, no. And the first person says, good, now we can talk. Because out of my capacity to say no, I have cleared a space for me, for my yes to have a whole another meaning. And every organization wants commitment, but if they can't create space for no. Now, when people say no, it's the beginning of a conversation. Will you marry me? No. Good, let's talk. Not, will you marry me? No. Goodbye. No, let's talk. And if people are forced to be team players, if they're forced to be on board, which always every client I ever had wanted someone not in the room to get on board, and I always think, well, what makes you think you're in the boat, you know?
And, right.
And so there's just a lot, and that's one of the five or six conversations I talk about in the book, that if you can engage people to own their capacity to refuse, if you can help them say, here's something I said yes to, I no longer mean, somehow in the saying of that to peers in the presence of others, that doubt or refusal I have no longer owns me. It doesn't control me. If my refusal is forced to stay silent, then it runs me. I don't run it. And I just think that's a condition. If we care about commitment, then there has to be space for people to say no. And the task of the leadership is just to listen to that, not to do anything about it. You know, we propose these changes, and people say, this isn't right. I have doubts and reservations. Well, the task of leaders is just to get interested. And this is what facilitators group, us on this call, when people give us a hard time, we know by now not to take it personally. People say, what you're doing makes no sense. You say, tell me more about it. I'm interested. It's beautiful. We don't have to defend or explain or rationalize who we are, and I think that's the task of leadership. This is a great place for people's doubts.
Yeah, you talk about deglamorizing leaders and bringing leaders into the circle, and you also talk about bringing everyone from the margins in. And usually when we talk about people from the margins, we're talking about the people who are disenfranchised. But when I read that, I was thinking about bringing everyone inside, including leaders, and everybody in sort of into that circle on the same level, and hopefully where everyone is asking questions and listening.
Exactly. And the reason to do it isn't a moral reason. It's just that if you want things to change, if having a future distinct from the past is something that you desire, then making leader the cause of that transformation, it becomes its limitation. And we see that. Every place that's highly dependent on a leader has an awful time adapting to a different future.
I don't see how individuals can own the transformation if it depends on someone else.
Exactly. Every client I ever had, in addition to getting people on board, wanted other people to change. In the whole era of reengineering, nobody who signed the check ever had their own job redesigned.
Right.
And there's something. There's some loss of integrity in that, and if you talk about spirit at work, and if we care about the spiritual dimension, which is the meaning and purpose dimension, that can't be received from another. It can't be sold to another. It has to be bought. It has to be taken in. And so part of the section of the book talks about inverting where cause resides. And our work is to help people realize that the audience creates the performer in this student creates the teacher. And the subordinates create the bosses. For years, when I hear subordinates whine about their boss, I always say, well, why are you creating the boss in that form? Why don't you decide to stop in reinforcing and giving power to that boss and get together with your peers and decide what kind of place you want this to be? Now, that doesn't go down easy in this culture.
It's a very
patriarchal culture. Brutal.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about having a particular context that have the power to bring something new into the world. And the attachment, despite what people say, the attachment that so many people have to maintaining, inadvertently, I might add, attachment to maintaining what is happening now, even though they say they want things to change in the future. And it's very interesting. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about what that context is that can really make a change.
Well, there's most of the context we operate out of now is an economist and an engineer's context. It says that the world is competitive, that it's based on self-interest, that the world is about solving problems. And so the shift in context would be to say, why don't we show up and talk about what possibilities did we come here for? What's the commitment we're willing to make instead of talking about the resistance that we have? Why don't we talk about what would it take for us to be owners of this future instead of waiting for someone else to change? And the biggest one is, why don't we talk about our gifts instead of our deficiencies? See, the engineer is only interested in problems. You tell an engineer you don't have a problem and you got a depressed engineer. And so the context of gifts, generosity, forgiveness, possibility, ownership, commitment with nothing expected in return, and that's our job, is to say this is our willingness to declare the world to be of this nature. And that's what I want to reinforce in the world, and I do that by declaring it. It doesn't make it so, but it leads me then to act in a way as if people's gifts, commitment, ownership, and possibility was what we came here to discover. We didn't come here to find out more about people's deficiencies, needs, what's wrong. And I just walked away from the idea of problem solving as being having the capacity to create a different future. All problem solving does is make tomorrow a little bit better than yesterday, but not of a different nature. And I think most of us on this call have a longing for some kind of larger shift than continuous improvement.
So how do you walk into a situation where that is entrenched in the culture that you have been describing as the culture that's not going to actually bring about transformation? How do you walk in as an individual and, it sounds trite, but make a difference? How do you walk in and model what it is that you'd like to see as a shift?
Well, partly I'm not a role model. I'm as caught in this culture as anybody. But
you're honest.
The way it becomes concrete is through the questions that we ask. You know, you're in a world that's patriarchal, that's organized around problems and deficiencies, just as a shorthand way. And so, but I have a choice as to what I choose to pay attention to. So I don't care what people are looking for. You know, for one thing, they invited you. They invited us. So I always assume that if they invited us in, they know who we are, regardless of our efforts. And so I would just ask people, they want to talk about problems, I just show disinterest. I said, that's nice. Now tell me, what are the gifts that you have? What are the gifts that you haven't fully delivered or brought into the world? I ask them, what is your contribution to what's going on here, which is an ownership question. I ask them, so what's the possibility that has the potential to inspire you? Now, they may say, well, I want to talk about problems. I say, I know you do. God bless you. Now, we will talk about problems, all right? But just for the moment, let's talk about possibility. What do you want to create here? What, you know, what would make a difference? And so we have the power to name the debate. And I know that's not what they have in mind, but I also know that what they have in mind isn't going to make a difference. But I never argue about what they have in mind. I just absorb it. I carry it and say, thank you, good point. I know nothing's possible. I know your boss is an animal. I know that that department doesn't thank you for that. Now, could we talk again about what your role in this has been? Can we talk about what are the strengths and gifts that your group has that's unique in this organization? Can we talk about what's the promise you would be willing to make without any expectation? So these questions, and a lot of the book is about questions, if they're framed in a personal, ambiguous, and anxiety-provoking way, these questions have the power to set in motion something that works on people. They may not have an answer at the moment, but it doesn't matter. I know that if I ask you, okay, I heard you complaining, how would you turn your complaint into a request? I know if I ask that question that the thought that maybe requests are more powerful than complaints will be set in motion.
Right.
If I say, and so I just think there's a power to questions that's enormously useful. And people want answers from us. They said, I didn't come here for questions. I came here for answers. And I just said, I know you do. God bless you.
Well, speaking of questions.
Right, we're ready for questions.
We are also ready for questions.
One other thing. I have the choice to be unseducible. I don't have control over where people are at the moment, but I do have a choice not to collude with what I know deep in my heart is just not useful. There's nothing wrong with problem solving or blaming or complaining or any of it. It's not that it's wrong. It's just not useful. And so if I know that, then I'm just not going to go along with it.
All right.
I'll be quiet now.
Oh, no, I wish we had 3 hours, and I'd love to hear you talk. I just know that there are lots of people out there who are dying to ask questions.
Well,
now,
exactly.
Peter, how did you want to do this? Did you want
I would love to hear. So there's about, 15, 20 people on the line. I would just like people to share what's the question that this evokes in you or what's the statement you want to make, and I'd like to just listen to that for a while, and then we can talk. And that gets us away from they have a question, I have an answer. You know what I mean? So structurally,
yeah,
we're shifting it to say, well, where does the answer reside? Well, it probably resides in the questions people ask. So could we just collect some questions or statements and start with your name? And that would be wonderful. And then after we collect them for a while, I'll respond and then people can join in.
Okay, that sounds great. So whoever would like to ask a question, you can hit *6 to unmute yourself. And as soon as you're unmuted, you go right ahead.
Now, let me structure this one more way, okay?
Yeah.
So partly I would love to know, given the conversation that Abby and I have been having, what has struck you about this conversation? Are we there?
I'm here. *6 will unmute you. Somebody get
hi, this is Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, I'm in town from Houston. What struck me about this conversation was in some ways the same thing that struck me about your book, Stewardship. That to me is one of the most profound books, that and Servant Leadership of the last 30 years, and is the profound simplicity and depth that comes from just being with what is rather than all the hoopla about what needs to be and how it needs to be different. So that's what really struck me about the conversation. And my question would be around something that you addressed earlier, but with the younger people in the workplace today who grew up with computers, who live on cell phones and BlackBerries and texting, how is it going to be possible to create a physical gathering that has meaning for these people? Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you, Anne.
So we're collecting questions now, so come ahead and ask away.
Or make statements.
Hi, I have a statement, and I love the way you set this up, Peter. This is Lynn Bourget, Doctor Appreciation. I started my work on strengths-based change and transformation in the middle 70s. Couldn't get it published. It was too early. And
I know,
so I'm just very... Say again. You're cutting in and out, Peter. Could you say that again?
I said you were born too soon.
Oh, listen. Story of my life. But I just am so comforted by what you're saying. It's very homey and friendly, and I have over 30 years of working this way. And to me, the greatest blessing has been not just the wondrous things that happen with clients when you work this way, because I don't ever accept the charge to go fix other people. I always get the leaders involved. But the greatest transformation, of course, has been for me, because of all the years of staying with it and using it in my own life. You know, my longest running client was 14 years, but I've been working on it for over 30 years, and it is the most joyful and blessed and relaxed, easy way to work, very nourishing and very rewarding. And I just really want to support you in your endeavors and in your outlook and in your philosophy. It's very lovely. Thank you so much.
You have not become cynical, Lynn. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, no, I don't have a cynical bone in my body after all the years of working this way.
Yeah.
It just reinforces all the positives all the time. And I now am to the point where I guess the only downside is that I just won't have negative people in my life at all. And if they want to bond around complaints or problems, I'm not there. It's not where I am at all. And for clients, of course, I'm willing to help them make that transformation. But in my personal life, no. Too hard on the middle-aged endocrine system.
You're funny. You should have a sign over your door warning people about that.
Oh,
Peter.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think they can tell in the first minute.
This is Deborah Darlington again. And I want to thank you again for being here tonight and being so generous with your time. I was at a workshop with you where you changed the arrangement of the chairs when everyone walked in, and it was a large group, and we disconnected all the chairs, and everybody kind of just sat wherever they wanted to. And I have to say that I have used that exercise a lot in my work. And it brings me to the question that kind of builds upon the first woman who posed a question said, and that is to link the idea that you speak about with community with the concept of presence and how one's presence within any kind of community has an effect, and it has an effect sometimes in ways that are intentional, sometimes that are unintentional, and sometimes that we are aware of and sometimes that we are not conscious of. And kind of the question that I sit with because of the nature of my work is how can my presence mingle with the people, especially that I work with, in more of a connected way of community, and how can that awareness of presence, I think, be introduced so that the level of awareness is raised, because to me it just seems that until we raise the level of awareness of presence, that's one of the struggles, I think, to get to to a sense of community.
Thank you. Other people like to share, say something?
Yes, this is Sandy Hinden. I just got your book. I'm so happy that you're talking about community. I do a lot of community development work, and I really see that we need sustainable communities on the whole planet. Because if we don't have those sustainable communities, people end up migrating all around the planet for work. So people need work throughout the whole world, sustainably, locally. And
beautiful.
I'm so happy you're talking about community and what it means both inwardly, interpersonally, and sustainable infrastructures in real local communities.
Yeah,
so I'm so happy.
Insight that mobility is a huge problem. Great insight. Anyway, thank you, Sandy. Others like to speak?
Just a reminder, too, that Peter would like to know what has struck you about the conversation so far. You ask your question.
Peter, my name is Henry. I have a question about shoes. I was very surprised by your statement that you had to pay attention to what sort of shoes you wear. I would have thought the opposite, that being a member of a community is what gives you the freedom to wear whatever shoes you feel comfortable.
No. It's my own shyness. You're absolutely right. It's a great point. It's an expression of my shyness, but it's a great point. Community means I'm accepted for whoever I am, including my shoes.
Thank you.
I'm going to wear my lousy shoes tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Great point. Very insightful. Thank you.
This is Joyce Kawasaki from Mill Valley, and I'm very much enjoying the conversation here. And I was wondering how the conversation goes over when you open this kind of dialogue in corporations that are patriarchal and competitive and problem-oriented.
Great question. Just a quick comment. I don't go to places that don't invite me. And so that means the world. See, you're not going to go to places that don't want you there. You haven't organized your life to be an intruder. So I just decide that because they invited me, that they are open to something happening. And
I see.
You with me? So I don't...
Yes.
Most organizations don't invite us in. Most people in this world don't read my books. But I'm not going to worry about that. I'm gonna worry about what I can't touch. So. Anyway, thank
That's
you.
That's great.
Yeah.
And thank you.
The other thing, if I give them what they ask for, I have betrayed them. Because what they ask for is more of what they have. So that kind of sort. Now I want to do it with kindness and with love, but I don't want to be distracted by their expectations. They're too small. So shall I respond to some of these where I can still hold them in my mind?
That sounds like a great idea.
So, see, the questions are so insightful. Deborah talked about presence, and the idea. I think it might have been Lynn that talked about having still be hopeful and not cynical. That's helpful, but it's not all there is. This isn't about us. And so, you say, how do I structure people's connection with each other that allows them to be present to each other? Now, one thing I kind of have increasing faith in is if I can get them to stop helping each other, giving advice to each other. It allows them to be with each other in a different way. And so I always admonish people when I break them into small groups, and I say it really loud as if I meant it. Do not be helpful. Don't give advice. Don't tell them what you did. Or don't ask them what they're going to do. Those are unkind questions and statements. Instead, substitute curiosity for advice and help. And every single time I break people in a small group, even if it's I've been with them for a week, I have to repeat it. I said, just ask people, why does that matter to you? And get curious instead of helpful. And that changes the tone and tenor of how people gather. That they realize they're there to make contact and hear each other, see each other, go deeper with each other. They're not there to solve each other. People are not a problem to be solved. They're a condition to be seen. And that's one thought. The dealing with the young, I think that Anne asked, it's a tough issue because I think the young being so wired electronically is stealing their senses. It's making them senseless. How to reach them, I don't have a simple answer to that, other than I'm not going to be romanced by the beauty of technology. I'm just going to treat it like a tool. I have a hammer, I have a computer, I have a cell phone. But I think the longing in young people to get connected, I think all the social networking is an expression of that longing. And when they show up in the room, which is the only time we have to deal with them, I assume they're showing up for an alternative to that. And I don't argue against the social networking, the Facebook and the iSpace. I don't argue against that, but I say, well, if they showed up, how do I get them in contact with each other? And so real social networking is face-to-face where the smell and the sight and the touch matters. But it's not an argument to be held. I don't argue against technology. They say this is the wave of the future, and I say, you bet, it sure is. Whatever people say, I just take their side, and it refuses and doesn't let the argument get distracting. Sandy talked about sustainable community. You know, sustainability and care for the planet will grow out of a sense of community. I don't know how I can care for the planet if we don't care for each other. And the more we can bring the planet and nature into the room, the more we can bring art into the room, the more something important and long-term gets affirmed. So I would only want to be in rooms that had art and life on the wall, that had plants in the corner, that had windows to the outside. In the community work I do, we always bring along food because it gives a sacred dimension to what's happening. And so, anyway, those are some thoughts. I'm getting a little static. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let me stop at that. I mean, the questions are just incredible. I think the world is waiting for what we have. Now, I don't think that's necessarily true, but I'm going to act that way. And then it changes the way that I show up. Many of you said, look at the way I show up is what sustains me. Well, that's a condition for something happening. But to me, the risk for me is to, and the change in me is I'm no longer interested in individuals. I'm not there to help individuals work on their issues. I'm not there for that. I'm there to kind of discover what's the communal possibility. What does communal transformation mean? That's why I wrote the book as an addition to individual transformation. Because I know if we transform a lot of individuals, the community and its quality doesn't shift. And so, to me, that's the work, is to say, well, what is the nature of how communities shift, how groups of people can shift? And I think it's through the structure, through the way they sit. One of the ground rules is you have to sit with your knees less than 9 inches from your neighbor, which keeps people, mostly men, from leaning back and sticking their shoes in the face of other people. And it's through the use of questions. It's the, and picking questions that are hard questions, ambiguous questions. And then when people have talked in a small group, don't ask them to report. I've come to the conclusion that reports are boring. Every time I have small group reports, I think, how many more groups are there and how long will this take? So I am helping the planet by eliminating the use of flip chart paper. And I just don't say report, and I make the distinction when I say that. I say, look, mostly you're used to reporting. And when small groups report, two things happen. One is they speak in such a general way that you don't know what they're talking about. And the second is the person reporting is speaking about things that never occurred in the meeting. I was at a conference, and the guy reporter for my group talked about something very interesting. It just didn't happen to be what we had talked about. And so instead of reports, you ask people, what struck you? And the question, what struck you, creates space for lightning to enter the room. And it creates space for people to be reflective about their experience. To ask them to report has them who try to remember their experience. And so I would rather say, well, what meaning occurred in your small group in the last 15 minutes? And they say, nothing meaningful happened. And I said, I know that. Now, if something meaningful had happened, what would it have been? And so this says that we're going to bring reflection into the room by the nature of that question, what struck you about the last 15 minutes. And if you have a room of anywhere from 50 to 500 people, all you need is six people to speak. And 90% of the experience has been reflected in those six people. And all these, just they're little details, you know. One of them alone is kind of a technique. But added together, you know, you're creating an art, a spirit, something cumulative in the details and nuances of people's experience that changes the nature of the culture of the space you're in, and you say, well, if our job is to create in this room, in this moment, an example of the future that we have in mind, and if we don't do that, then nothing we come up with is going to make a difference.
Say that again, Peter?
I said that the task is in every room. I want to make that room, in terms of how we are together, how we speak and meet and make contact. I want that to be an example of the future that we have in mind. Whatever your client wants for the future in terms of culture, relatedness, the things you coach them on, it has to occur in this room, in this moment. So you're changing the room, the world, one room at a time. And if it doesn't occur in this moment, then we can talk about the most beautiful things in the world, but if our being together wasn't beautiful, then that talk will have had no meaning. It will be wishful thinking.
Peter, are these details included in the book?
As best I could, you know. After the book is published, then you figure out what you wanted to say, but most of them are in there.
Right. Uh-huh.
They are. This is exactly what's in the book.
Uh-huh.
I think.
I think it's pretty accurate.
And the other thing about the book is, you know, the book is an example. Like, I care more about the look, feel, white space, type size, aesthetic of the book than I do about its content. And so that was the other hope I had in this book, was to make, and each book I've done, I've tried to say, well, I want the book itself to be an invitation in the way that it looks and feels and the colors and shading and stuff like that. So like in this book, every chapter I started by a paragraph saying, here's what the chapter is about. If you don't want to read it, you can move on. So you try to make even the experience of reading a book a taste of what the book is about.
You use the word hospitality. I love that in the context of...
Yeah, me too. I think that's at the center of our work. If you say, so what's our work about? It's about the welcoming of strangers. So another small little detail is to say, whenever I have people break into small groups, I say, I want you to be with those people you know the least. And even if a team has been together 25 years, there's someone in there they know or have the least feeling for. And so by saying the way to come together is with people you know the least is a concrete expression of hospitality. To be hospitable is to say, I welcome you, even if you're a stranger or my enemy. In the traditional cultures, like in the Middle East, if someone knocked on your door, you had to let them in, feed them, and give them your best bed, even if they were your enemy. And to me, that's one way to frame the work, is to focus on gifts, to create a space wherever you are that is hospitable. And say that that's what matters to us. And the ultimate frame that I heard John McKnight in Love is that our job is to bring the gifts of those on the margin into the center, like you said before. And to me, that's the task of leadership. That's the task of our coaching, our interventions, are to help them invite into the center people that have been on the margin. And you can't do that by talking about deficiencies. You do that by talking about gifts.
Yeah, you ask a great question. What is the gift that you currently hold in exile?
I know, I love that. I got that from Robert Sardello. It's Sophia. Sophia's kind of feminine wisdom. And he wrote in there that Sophia holds a gift of her feminine wisdom in exile in a world that doesn't want it. And when I read that, I thought, oh, wow, there's something powerful about that. And a lot of these ideas are an affirmation of the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
My intention is to try to give form and structure to what a feminine use of power is about. And it's no accident that many of the people in this field now are women, because I think that is the work. And it's not about men and women, it's about the feminine, because we don't need the reinforced masculine energy in this culture anymore. It's doing really well. And it dominates the context of this culture, winning at any cost, of the decider, all of the stuff that goes on. And so to me, that's the other thing, is to say, well, how do we give form and structure so that the feminine can enter institutional life and find a place there for it, alongside the masculine, which is also very useful.
So, Peter, what has struck you about this conversation we've been having today?
Well, partly is your voice, Abby, and your really deep, deep understanding of who I am and what I care about, and the questions you ask, you are unencumbered by methodology, and I really appreciate that. So that's part of it. I just felt so like you knew what you were getting when you got me, and that's just very touching. And the other is just the questions people ask. They're so insightful and so to the point, because the questions are unanswerable. That's what touches us, is when somebody gives voice to an unanswerable question, and you say, that's true, that is a tough one, thank you for that. Because then you realize that your efforts to answer it were futile, and you can just, value the question. This call appreciates the work that I do, and so that counts for everything.
Well, it has been an amazing, amazing call. And I'm sure that we would all gladly go on all night, but we are reaching the end of our time together. And I'd like to give you, Peter, an opportunity to say whatever it is that's been hovering around the corner of your mind that you'd like to finish with and leave us with.
Well, I like the title of this, spirit at work. So this is a community of people that's willing to stand on the platform of we are here to create spirit in the world. And you know, we're a little nervous, so we don't call it spiritual or spirituality, and everybody has to say, when I mean spirituality, I don't mean religious. But I do think that the spirit at work is a speaking, or it's kind of a calling that it reinforces, and it acknowledges that there's something mysterious in the world, whatever you want to call it. And so whenever, you know, I get a call and said that the name of this is Spirit at Work, I know there's a community of people that are doing something really important in the world, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, I am incredibly grateful, Peter, that you are in the world and that you are in my world.
Yes,
and
I am.
I know I speak for everyone on this call when I say that.
So, look, can I make a quick offer? You know, there's an email of pbi@att.net. So if anybody wants to email and anything, I do respond to it.
Could you repeat that?
pbi@att.net.
Is that B as in Paul, D as in dog, I?
No, Block, B as in Block.
Oh, okay.
My name,
thank
Peter
you.
Block. Yeah, sorry about that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Peter, thank you so much. This has been absolutely incredible. And I wish you great joy and lots of love from all of us. And thank you, everybody, for joining me and Peter and each other on this call. And hopefully we'll have lots more time together in the future to have more conversations. So have a lovely evening, and I think we'll say goodnight now.
God bless
you. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Abby. Good night.
Thank you.